Hi, this is Circulating Ideas, the librarian interview podcast hosted by me, Steve Thomas. My guests today are Lauren Presley, who is the head of instruction and an associate librarian at the Z. Smith Reynolds Library at Wake Forest University, and Linda Kellum, who is the data services and government information librarian at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Lauren and Linda, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for being on with me. You guys are amazingly, I've done 14 episodes. You're the first academic librarians to be on the show. So congratulations on that.
Woohoo!
And the reason I wanted to have you guys on together, you were kind of, before recently, you guys were both on my list to interview, but separately. But then you guys had a little blog exchange sort of thing after you guys had lunch together and had a lot of fun conversation together. So that's what made me think of putting you guys on here together to talk. And before we get to that conversation you guys had with that, how did the two of you meet?
Well, sorry, I have a bit of a cold, but I'll try my best. We both went to graduate school together. We did our MLIS at UNCG together and graduated the same year. I don't remember which class we met in, though. It may have been through our student organization that we actually officially met.
Yeah, I think it was. I'm not sure that we took classes together, really.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. But it's all a blur, too.
Yeah. So. So far in the past. Linda was the president of the LISA group on campus, and I was vice president with her, so we got to work together a lot through that.
Yeah. Had good parties.
How long ago was that?
That was 2005 to 2007. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So yeah, we both graduated in 2007, and we were both working as paraprofessionals at our institutions that we then took on professional positions at. So Lauren at Wake Forest and myself at UNCG.
Well, that's always nice when you get to stay where you want to stay.
Yeah, definitely.
Are you guys from the North Carolina area or originally?
Yeah, I actually am from Raleigh, so I've spent pretty much my whole life within 3 hours of the same place.
Yeah, I'm from Greensboro, so born and bred. At some point, I think I'll leave. Maybe. We'll
no
see.
Specific plans, but
no.
And we're recording this just a couple of weeks after ALA, and you guys both went to that, and it sounds like from reading your wrap-up kind of things that you both spent a lot of the conference in meetings.
Yes. I started calling it adult ALA, that we are now having the adult ALA, that this is the grown-up version of it. So I didn't get to see a lot of programs, unfortunately.
Which committees are you guys on?
Yeah, so I'm on ALA Council, so that takes up a lot of time doing sort of the policy work of the organization, and I'm on the LEADUP Board of Directors, so spending a lot of meetings doing the sort of business of the Library and Information Technology Association as well.
And I'm on the ACRL LPSS, which is the Law and Political Science section. I'm their incoming vice president, so I was doing a lot of steering stuff. And then also Godort Education Committee, which is going to start up a webinar series, so I'm excited about that. But those are my two main ones.
Yeah, and Lauren, I appreciated you and other people on council that were sort of live tweeting the sessions.
Yes.
That helped people who couldn't be there.
Yeah, we all kind of sit, and all the Twitterers on council kind of sit in the same area, and it's really helpful because we can always refer to each other's tweets and point out things, because although it seems kind of like a dry and serious meeting, there's a lot of information being thrown out there that a lot of people are interested in hearing.
Definitely. It was cool to be able to see that while you're sitting in a session. See what's going on.
It helps everybody, I think, to be able to, because I know the council meetings are open, but you know, people, even if you're at the conference, like Linda was saying, you're at another session or something at the same time, so it's nice to be able to keep up with what council's doing without having to go to the meeting itself. I mean, you obviously don't get everything out of it, but you get the highlights.
Exactly. And the highlights are really what most people want. Most people don't
Yes.
want to miss all of that.
The resolutions that came up, some people were it seemed like there was some controversy going on in the room, even of whether ALA should be talking
Yeah.
about these things and like
Yeah, I mean,
the
that was a
Wikipedia kind of things and.
it's a continuous struggle with that. And it was interesting this time because in the past, the same types of resolutions have come up and we've spent a long time debating them. And this time, those types of resolutions came up and they were pretty quickly put aside. But then when we had one that was a clear-cut library issue, we had like 20 minutes of people standing up saying, I totally support this. I think it's so important because it was such a stark contrast to the other ones that had come before the group. It's interesting though, because one of the things that we talked about sort of in some small group work in council was that there is this perception that council spends a lot of time on stuff that's not really that important. And one of the things that came out of that was sort of helpful for me as a newer council member was understanding that the really big important things that we all agree with are library issues. Council will decide to make a group that focuses all their energy on that and spends full-time energy. And the stuff that's not that level of priority comes through council. So therefore we get all the stuff that doesn't seem like it's by design. The big stuff gets its own group and council sort of deals with the one-off issues or things that people want to be one-off issues, like WikiLeaks or something.
So the big issues kind of come to everybody, and then if it's important enough, quote unquote, it's spun off into a smaller group.
Right, exactly, yeah. And they'll do reports and present to council and they'll create materials for librarians to use in their day-to-day work. But it's not, that sort of thing becomes something where people who really specialize in that content area can serve in those capacities rather than putting it before the whole council.
And is this your first time on council, or?
Yeah, this is my first term, so it's I think I'm about halfway through it. I've sat in the meetings a few times, but it takes a little while to figure out exactly what all is going on.
Do you think you would run again next time?
Yeah, definitely.
It's been a good experience for you.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things too that you spend so much time learning how it works. And then if you also enjoy it, then it seems a shame not to use that knowledge you have about how it works. So I sort of feel like this is sort of the training wheels time period, right? I'm certainly participating and I've gotten up and said things and I vote, but I'm sort of learning it. And I feel like if I could run and get elected for a second term, I could probably start to use some of that knowledge a little more effectively.
Cool. Were you able to attend any sessions, Lauren?
I attended, the only ones I was really able to attend were the ones that were tied to the LEADA board of directors work, because they were scheduled intentionally so that all of the LEADA board could go to those. So the LEADA President's Program, Top Tech Friends, those types of things.
I do appreciate the document that came out of talking about where ALA is going to streamline things quite a bit for going forward, so there's not so much spread out of different hotels and so many programs on top of each other, so that people can get to the programs that they want to get to a little easier.
Yeah, I think I don't know if you want to jump in, please do. I was just really excited about that personally. I actually have never really attended an ALA that felt program focused. I know that there's so many good things that go on, and I think that by streamlining it a little bit, A, it'll make it so much easier for people who just want to see programs, and it'll also allow people to really select sort of the top-notch programs, and then they'll all be able to be streamed because by putting them all in the same place, we can build that in to the conference venue. So hopefully we can either for paid attendees or something, have the ability to get that content later.
Yeah, we were looking at it more from the collaborative aspect and how much, I mean, LPSS is a tiny organization, tiny section. So who we can collaborate with, and it's going to encourage that. And I think that's a good thing because some of the sessions or some of the programs tend to overlap each other in content. And we could learn from each other rather than kind of siloing ourselves.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I would love it if they could start streaming it, because then you could have, because they have, the virtual ALA conference, but it's a entirely separate event.
Right.
2 3 weeks later, it'd be nice to even to have another, pay structure that you can pay a certain amount and view stuff on
Yeah.
streaming and everything too. So.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly lots of logistical things to work out, like speaker agreements and all of that. But that's part of the intention behind this, is to sort of modernize modernize people's ability to participate and observe the program.
Yeah, and I've heard part of the problem sometimes with streaming is the deals that you make with the convention centers themselves. Even there's some, like, in the contract, you have to already have made those agreements with them. Like, you have to use their equipment and their people, you know, and everything. Right. So you can't just set up just set up your own webcam and stream it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I think Jason Griffey tried to do that a while back and was not allowed to because of that.
Yeah, I think there were some other issues tied up in that. But yeah, it's been controversial off and on the past several years.
Well, hopefully we can move. Hopefully our technology-focused organization can.
Exactly.
And Linda, was there any session in particular that you got to see that you were excited about?
I was just looking through my notes to see if there's one. The library and wardrobe session was quite fun. I went to that one off of the blog, Library and Wardrobe. It got very heated, apparently, because I've never seen this show, but What Not to Wear. Apparently, there's quite a few people who love it and quite a few people who hate it. So that was fun. But I think the highlight for me was the Godort ProQuest breakfast, because Julian Bond, who is a NAACP president, recent NAACP president, spoke and talked about his efforts in SNCC during the civil rights movement. So that for me was quite a good one, and probably my favorite. But yeah, there was a lot of data stuff. I also write conference reports for Against the Grain Journal. And so I was going to some of the stuff for them, and you'll see the reports at some point when I actually write them.
And
a few things.
And Lauren, was it you that got to go see David?
Was it David Weinberger?
Yes, David Weinberger, yes.
Oh, yeah.
I actually, one of my meetings let out a little early, so I was able to get a slip into that, which was so exciting for me. I really have enjoyed his works, and I'm sort of in the middle of his current one, which is what the talk focused on. But you know, he's an engaging speaker, and he talks about ideas that are really relevant for libraries. And in this particular talk, it was particularly interesting if you are familiar with Reddit, because he spent a not insignificant portion of it sort of explaining Reddit culture as a discussion of different bubbles on the internet and sort of the culture that shows up there. So it was quite entertaining.
Yeah, he's somebody that I've enjoyed for a long time. One of my favorite books for a while was Everything is Miscellaneous.
Yeah, that's a fantastic book.
Yeah, and I have his new one checked out from the library, but I have not had a chance to read it. Because I always have that huge stack next to my bed of things that I've checked out.
Exactly. And that is why I'm halfway through, because I work from that stack in different, depending on my needs. So I haven't totally gotten through it yet.
Yeah, you also went to the Mover and Shaker lunch. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Because I heard a lot about the speaker at that.
Yeah, so that was also sort of an amazing event. It's something really nice that Library Journal does at annual conferences, is they have this lunch where anyone who's been recognized in their Movers and Shakers program is invited. And they do sort of a mix and mingle, which is amazing, you know, to get to interact with all the people who are there. And then they serve a nice lunch, and they have a speaker, and they normally do a signing. So this year, and his name just escaped my mind, but I can send it to you if you want for the notes. But it's the quote, "Boy Who Harnessed the Wind." So in Africa, there's this young man, and I wish I could remember his name, but he knew that his village needed water. So he sort of self-educated and self-taught himself how to make a windmill, which wasn't something that he could even ask anyone there how to do. And he, using books and, you know, just sort of teaching himself, figured this out and ended up using it to produce electricity, which, you know, adds a whole, you know, element of potential to the community that wasn't there before. And he's now actually in America studying in college, but his plan is to take the knowledge he has and go back and use that to help his community further. So it's just one of those completely mesmerizing and amazing things. He has a TED Talk that's quite good, so he's, you know, right there. But it's also sort of, it was kind of like dissident to me, because we're sitting at this very nice lunch, you know, and we're all kind of dressed up because we're at the conference, and it's just lovely. And here's someone speaking about such absolute poverty. So it was such a, you know, it's a difficult thing even to hear, but an important message. And it was amazing that they were able to get him to come and speak at the conference.
That's very cool. Yeah. Was there anything else about your ALA experience that you guys wanted to share? It sounded like you guys were having a lot of fun. So.
Yeah. We should create more of the little games like we did for the picture.
Oh, yeah, Linda set up this. Can you tell the listeners about that? First of all, I had asked if you guys could get a picture together to use for this podcast.
Yeah. So we just put out on Twitter. We had a picture, but it was right after we got gotten there, and I looked like I was about to fall asleep. So we made it into a game and asking people on Twitter if they could find us at the conference and take a picture. We would get them a cup of coffee. And then it became Laura and myself and Lisa Carlucci would get an adult drink. But we had a few participants, not very many, but it was just kind of fun to do this informal, hey, if you can find us together, which it actually is really hard. I only saw Lauren, I think, 3 times.
Yeah, I think so.
So, I mean, I just don't, you know, we just, our paths don't cross that often at the conference because we're in our own areas, but it was pretty fun. But we should come up with another one, like a little.
Yeah.
Thing like that, very small, because they have the big game, these aren't the droids you're looking for, but it's very complex, and I never got quite through that one, so.
Well, everybody, when you're listening to this, you can go to the blog and see the picture that they provided.
The winner.
And who was the winner?
Oh, Peter Bromberg.
Yes.
Yeah, he was the winner.
Okay, so after the conference, actually, this was before the conference, I think, actually. When I came back, I was looking at Linda's blog, and I saw that you had, when I was doing my initial research on things to talk to you guys about, your blog was called one thing, and then you changed it.
Yeah.
Can you tell me why you decided, what the old name was, what the new name is, and why you decided to change that?
Yeah, sure. So the original one was just Linda MK, and I just put it on there because when I started the blog, I had no idea what to call it. And originally it was just going to be for me, really. So after the conference, or actually during the conference, I kind of had this idea of doing this librarianship equals. And it kind of, for me, follows with Twitter language. Like, I don't know, I find myself doing that on Twitter all the time whenever I want to say, you know, you use these signs because you only have so many characters. But I think it's nice that it's open-ended. Librarianship equals whatever you have to do. You know, it's not just this one thing. It's not just instruction. It's not just books. It's not just ebooks. It's all of the things that we do. And that was kind of the philosophy behind it. But yeah, I finally decided to change it after, I guess, three or four years now. That it's been existing, so.
I'm going to get to another one of Linda's posts later, and I already told her before we started recording which one it's going to be. But first, we'll go back to, like I said, the initial reason for having you guys on together was the little lunch you guys had. Do you guys get to get together for lunch together very often and have these little chats?
Not as often as I would like.
Yeah.
we are able to manage it. A couple times a year, right, Linda?
Yeah. It seems like annual. That we've been doing a lunch at annual, and then, or some beignets one time.
Right.
Annual. And then hopefully that continues. That's a lot of fun. And then try to get together probably once a year after that.
And how far apart are you guys?
25 minutes. So 30 minutes. Not very far. It's hard because you get into your own work. Mm-hmm. And your own life, and Lauren has a child, so it's a very different, you know, it's not that easy. And there's also the psychological barrier of, oh, I've got to drive to
a whole other city.
Yeah.
Well, when you guys got together this time, you talked about a lot of different things. Looked like the big overarching thing was that you guys were talking about rethinking reference. Can you talk a little bit about that, of what sort of your ideas were
Well, I think that, and this was over the beignets, I think we started that
Yes.
discussion. But my position at my library, I've had a couple different ones, and they bounce between reference and technology. And so for me, the question about reference often starts with this place where I don't feel as confident with my reference work as I do with other things, and that I don't think of myself as a reference person. Which I want to be very careful to say that that doesn't mean that I don't value reference. It's just that that's not, you know, I sit on the desk and I question everything I do, and I see someone approaching and I'm like, oh no, what if I can't do this thing that they need? So maybe it's a lack of confidence thing. But as I've thought about it more, I realized that the type of academic background I have is really well suited to a very, very narrow type of research. I have a women and gender studies background and a philosophy background, and philosophy research just does not look like regular humanities research or social science or anything like that. And the type of women's studies work I did was much more on the theoretical side, so it looked more like philosophy work. And what I realized is if someone comes with a philosophy type of question, I can totally nail that in a way that the rest of the reference department might not be able to. But if it's like a English lit question or something, that's where I feel a little more nervous. So it made me start to rethink, like, does it make sense to do reference by subjects the way that we've been breaking it down? Or are there like research families? You know, like maybe there's this sort of theoretical thread that runs through other types of disciplines too, and that any of those types of questions really should go to the person that can do that type of research. You know what I mean? Like, so maybe there's a different way to group it or something. So I sort of have been playing with that idea a little bit along the way. And that's what we started talking about over beignets, and then Linda sort of built on that and had some other perspectives too.
Yeah, ours, so I do training with interns. We have LIS interns in our library, and they're graduate students. And we ran into the same kind of problem because a lot of them come from an English background, typical. Very few of them come from any other kind of, I mean, there'll be one a year maybe who comes from a different kind of background. And so having them kind of not just focus on the resources, the databases, the catalog, those kinds of things, but try to think of how the research process would work for a researcher was really important to me. Because I think if you can think of how a researcher works, it makes it easier to be able to bring in the wide variety of resources you would have available for you. So after this conversation with Lauren, the original one, we started rethinking the way we did our training here. And instead of just jumping into like nursing resources or business resources, we would do social science research, humanities research, and make sure that everybody was kind of on the same page to understand what's important to a social scientist versus a humanities person, and what kinds of problems are you going to see? What kinds of issues will they have when they come to the reference desk or come to you as a liaison? And that I think is just I don't think it's revolutionary, but I think it's a newer way of trying to rethink how we approach training, how we approach our own work. And Lauren's right. I think you can start to see these families become families of type of researchers. It becomes more important than just the resources themselves.
And Linda, you've written not particularly to this, but you've written a lot about embeddedness. How do you see being an embedded librarian as being a part of this?
Embeddedness for me, it's two things. One is partly in my subject area, so I'm a political scientist by training, and I'm embedded in the political science program. The other is in a living learning community. And I really do value embeddedness because I think it can create these meaningful relationships. I mean, the whole point of embeddedness is to create a deeper relationship with the user, to understand how they're doing their research, to understand where you can fit into that process rather than just responding to what they need. You know, it's a more proactive approach rather than a reactive approach. And I like that a lot. And I think that, but I think there's a tension there. And this has come up a lot actually since we've talked recently about, you know, do you have to be a subject specialist to do a liaison? Do you have to be a subject specialist to be embedded? And there's this is a huge debate right now, it seems like, in the academic library world. Do liaisons need a second master's, right? And I think this alternate model that we have, where you look at it, research as a process and you look at families of research, might be a way to get around the issue of there's no way you can have subject specialists who have second masters in every single field in your, you know, in your user area, in your library. It's just, it's, it, you know, you have limited resources. So I think embeddedness works very well, but it's a scalability issue when it comes to actually doing embeddedness through in the same level throughout all of the different programs. And I'm talking embeddedness, not just virtual Blackboard embeddedness. I mean embeddedness in the wide variety of things that we see.
That includes physically going to the classroom and things like that.
Yeah, or even teaching in the part. I mean, I teach in the department a class that's actually a political science class. And I'm seeing more and more librarians are taking on actual content of that subject classes, and not just doing kind of one-shot instruction for the class, or not just doing the information literacy component. They're actually teaching content too. And so that kind of embeddedness, because of that relationship, I started it in the fall of 2011. My user stats for consultations in political science have just doubled. And, you know, it's really interesting. It'll be interesting to see what happens this next year when I keep doing it. Will they keep going up? Can I sustain that? I don't know. You know, that's an issue. But it really has created a relationship where the students feel like I'm an authority. I'm a person who's in the department. I'm someone they can come to. I'm not just someone sitting over in the library. Which is
it. Yeah, I mean, that's good to be out there, to be, like you said, to put a face to the library.
Definitely, yeah. And there was a... we are really behind in our library journals that we pass them around in the library. And yesterday I was just reading this thing from June 15th, 2011. You can see how far we're behind in this, but it's from Michael Stevens. And he was saying that we need to move from source focus to research process based instruction. And we should find ways to do it at the point of need for students, because they are not coming to ask the librarians right. Waiting for them in the library. And it's like, when I read that, I was like, oh my God, this is Lauren. This is our discussion. Yeah. Uh-huh. But just figuring out how do you do that? You know, that's the interesting part. That's what we've been trying to do.
Right.
And I think sort of tied to that, understanding the different discipline, like families or whatever, understanding what the research actually looks like for the person doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Helps you understand how to target that point of need a little more effectively, you know, because, for example, there are some disciplines where you might sort of come up with your argument, and as you develop your paper, start looking for sources to support your argument, right? So you would look for the resources later in the process. When I talk about the philosophy research, often what happens there is you find a source to start with, and then you build your argument from there. So it's important to target the reference help at the very, very beginning, but not necessarily towards the end. So I think having a really good understanding of subject matter, even if you're not an expert, can help you understand how to target. And embedding is a really good way to sort of get that eye to the discipline and how it's really done in the field.
Right. And so embeddedness is obviously what is really an important part of the 21st century librarian, and as a general concept. And I know you guys talked about that a little bit. I liked the one mm-hmm. tweet that you even said of your plotting your future library, the perfect library, and I think Linda said she's going to be the head of undergrad research.
You have to make up that position.
That sort of came from some of this other conversation about sort of where people's strengths really are and an idea of sort of personas. I don't know if, Linda, if you want to explain that a little.
So we have this idea of personas, which we've had a lot of fun with, and I'm really excited about this, and it came from a book that was written by a woman named Laura Vanderkam. It's called 168 Hours, You Have More Time Than You Think. And it's a time management book that talks about this idea of 168 hours. And the key thing that we thought was interesting is this idea of core competencies, which is borrowed from business literature. And it's really coming from the idea of like comparative advantage, and that you have opportunity costs for every task which you decide to take on. So if you decide to create a tutorial tutorial. There are other things that you are giving up to create that tutorial. You're giving up time on collection management. You're giving up time. You could do teaching to create that tutorial. And that sometimes you be better at creating that tutorial than you are at collection management. Or you may be better at collection management than creating that tutorial. So deciding which is your core competency and where should you focus your time is a really important thing when you're thinking of time management. And so we started talking about this idea and how we could relate it both at a macro level in the library to kind of job positions or duties or tasks or things that need to be done, as well as the micro level for a person has to figure out what they have to do day to day. And Lauren, the conversation that Lauren and I have on our blog is really more the macro level. And that's where the whole idea of the fantasy library came from. Fantasy Library League, I think is what Lauren said, came from, was this idea that, you know, if your perfect library, you would have people who are, you've identified their core competencies and are able to place them in to those particular situations. You can pick up here, Lauren.
Yeah. So for example, with my reference story I was telling earlier, like reference is definitely something I can do, but I don't think of that as my core competency. I think of my core competency being more around teaching and strategic planning type work. So every hour I sit at the desk, that's not an hour right that I'm spending doing strategic planning type work or working on instruction issues for my library. So Linda, however, when I talk to her, you can tell like she has this thing in her that is so amazing that we're just so connected to the students. And like I completely care about the students, and that is why I do my job. But like that day-to-day interaction isn't the driving thing that gets me out of bed in the morning. Whereas for Linda, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were talking about how you see them evolve over time.
Yeah. For me, that's the best thing is to be able to, I'm now in my fifth year, so I've seen people as freshmen come in and then graduate, and that's so exciting. That's why I went into education, was to be able to see people develop. And, you know, that's why I come to work every day, is really to work with these students and make sure that they're getting the education and they have the skills they need to leave, you know, which doesn't mean that I don't care about the library of the future.
But. Right. And like you had said that you think about ebooks personally, but it's not like the thing that gets you out of bed for work. Whereas like, where are ebooks going and what will our students need in 20 years and how can we be ready for that? Those are all like the very exciting issues that make me excited to be in the field and do my job. So we're talking about how you can capitalize on the things that you're particularly good at and particularly passionate about. And if there are ways that you can sort of maximize that in the library, which is where that tweet that you were referring to about the dream library came from.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. And you guys had also talked about, in terms of the 21st century library of, and this is sort of blending the things we've just talked about, of librarians turning more into collaborators, not just being, I guess in the past it was sort of, we were sitting there waiting for people to come to us and say, oh, I'm doing research on this topic. Tell me how to find research. And now we want to get more involved.
Yeah. So I certainly want to do more research on this because I think there's actually like a real article and not just a blog post on this. but it's pretty clear from the literature and from history of library classes and things like that, that libraries for a while were much sort of about like collecting things, right? So that we could have them, preserve them, sort of serving people. But not really like the service-oriented that we think of today, that sort of sitting at the desk and waiting. And then there's been this huge push about being really proactive and friendly and sort of focusing on the user or the customer, or however you want to say it, trying to be more of a service provider. And at my institution, I've sort of witnessed a shift. We certainly still are in that service-focused place, but we also are moving towards a collaborative space too. And part of that is because we had an administration that really supported that. We had a provost, I said had because the provost who was talking about this has since left, but she really sort of challenged us to see ourselves as more of an equal player in a lot of discussions on campus and not just sort of a secondary class of people. And all of a sudden that, you know, it sort of opened the door to help us pursue faculty status, which is something we had voted on and wanted to do. And as part of that, we serve on committees, like it's pretty standard, university committees. But we also, in many cases, actually get to collaborate with faculty on projects. So it's not that we are the librarian sort of representing that perspective and offering service, but more like from an information professional perspective, this is something you should consider, you know? So it's that sort of where I'm a partner with you in this process. And I think that it's another way of looking at embeddedness, because then you're embedded in the business of the university, really, and all sorts of different capacities. And it's something that we're still sort of playing out and figuring out what our role exactly is. But I think that there's a lot of potential for the field for that, because in this environment where the information we have access to changes so quickly and the different modes of getting information change so quickly, having an information professional be a collaborator is a pretty good idea, because we can sort of help with all sorts of issues that people might not even know are issues because they don't even know that certain things exist. So I have a real sort of focus on that and do a lot of speaking around that issue of sort of moving us towards this collaborator space. But it's certainly, you know, different institutions have different cultural situations. So for some places it might take longer, for some places it might not make sense. But I think that in a lot of cases it does make good sense.
Especially the academic, I mean, this is, you know, the academic library, it just seems like we have to be on this path in some ways. But yeah, it definitely fits in with it, like you said, the embeddedness aspect of it. I actually was, I think it was about 2 years ago, I was working with a faculty member who was applying for a grant, and she was required on that grant to actually have a library collaborator. I forget how it was actually worded on the grant, but they asked her to have somebody who could be a library contact to be able to help with finding data. And I got to be that, you know, and it was really cool. It didn't mean much except me doing my day-to-day work of helping them find the data they needed. But to see that starting, this idea that, you know, when you are doing this kind of research, there are experts, there are people who do this every day who can provide, not just provide, but also work with you, develop the research that you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, what I think is great is that I think there's actually, you guys were saying, you know, this is good for academic libraries. I think this is good for all libraries, because it really is. I mean, it's sort of, you have to get involved in your community, whatever your community is.
True.
I was thinking, as you were describing everything, I was thinking that's exactly how things work in public libraries where I work, because you have to let especially the stakeholders know, I mean, the people who are funding you, understand what your importance is to the community, but you have to let the community know how you're, you know, if we're not letting the community know what we've got available to them, then we're not doing, then they're not going to see the value in us. And it's the same thing I think I've heard a lot of school librarians talk about, that the teachers don't understand what they can offer to them. So I think that's a good overall lesson for the whole profession.
And I think there's just so many ways that we can collaborate that are hard even for us to wrap our heads around, because we're so busy with the day-to-day sort of existing duties. But like when you talk about data, like someone who's newer to the field, like a faculty member who's newer to the field thinking about how to structure data, they could talk to a librarian for some perspective on that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And that's I think that's the big growth area for this, is going to be the data management issues, especially the research institutions. If people have, you know, NSF now has a mandate that you have to have a data management plan for your research data.
And similarly to that, people who are considering different avenues for publishing and want to consider open access, they can partner with a librarian to understand what those avenues are. So like sort of not a partner in the writing, but a partner in the getting the thing published, which is similar, that there's governmental regulations about certain types of research needing to be open access. I've done a lot of sort of collaborative work with teaching, because, I mean, teaching is really about conveying information, and as an information professional, I have a good sense of information, you know, so like, I just think that there's a lot of different realms where we can be really good collaborators, but it's hard to either think of ourselves that way sometimes or to carve out the time to do it.
Well, I think it's hard to highlight, this is what I wrote about more, it's hard to highlight what you're doing. And we've had this huge issue in our library, because we spend a lot of time on assignment creation when working with our faculty members to help them create assignments. That's different from what you traditionally think of as a librarian's duty. Yeah. But how do you then track that? How do you like prove that? How do you show that to the administration? That's the hard part. And so we've been trying to think, okay, when do we track this kind of collaborative work that we're doing? How do we do it in a way that's meaningful? And my supervisors hit on the idea of more using narratives and stories and things like that to help track, but for, because I'm a numeric data person, I want numbers, but that's harder.
Yeah, I was going to say that has to be very appealing to you, that I think the profession overall really does have to be more focused on data, and because we're having people wanting to know, how are you useful to us, so we have to be able to provide it in a concrete way, and numbers can do that.
And it's been a bit of a, I think, a shift in our mentality here, because we've had to do a little bit of proof of worth, and some people haven't necessarily kept great statistics, and it's not, you know, it's hard if you, that's not your tendency. I tend to just keep statistics like crazy, you know, I'm just like, oh, here, I'll count that. But other people, they may have a great conversation at coffee with someone about their assignment, and then that just goes away as if it didn't exist. But that's incredible collaborative work, and that needs to be documented somehow.
Right, where the two of you have lunch together and we get 6 good blog posts out of it. Do you have any other thoughts on the 21st century library or librarians that you wanted to share that you didn't already?
I think that generally the themes on that for me are to have a real sense of the importance of self-educating and continuing to learn, because, I mean, right, we graduated in 2007, and there are already things that are part of my day-to-day work that I didn't take any classes on in library school. So, like, a real drive to self-educate, whether that's from reading or workshops or developing a personal learning network through Twitter or whatever it is. I think that there's an importance for having a good sense of design, both in, like, the actual products that you create, whether it's a learning object or a handout or something, but also a sense of design as a process for planning how spaces work or how an instruction unit is developed or how to design a website to be a sort of interactive, useful experience. I think a sense of flexibility is really important because things do change so much. And, you know, it'll change day to day, as most of us know. So that sort of sense of flexibility will continue to be important. And I think that having sort of an entrepreneurial spirit is always a good thing leading to the future, because we know a lot of change is coming. So the ability to sort of look at the environment and take some risk and try out some different ideas can only help the field as a whole and help your individual community as well. Linda?
Sounds great. No, I mean,
ditto.
No, the flexibility, I mean, with the interns that we have in, I think they're starting to realize that kind of the traditional understanding of the library is not true, and that you have to kind of modify any ideas or preconceptions you have about what the library means, because what that library means is going to depend on any institution you work in too. I mean, you go to some institutions, they have a really quiet reference desk, or they don't have a reference desk anymore. You come to ours and it's hopping at certain times of the day. I mean, it's from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m., it's a madhouse out there. And that's a very different kind of institution than you would see at some other places. So flexibility for me is the key. When I'm hiring an intern, I definitely want to try and figure out how flexible they are, how adaptable they are, how patient they are, that those kinds of things are more important than whether or not they can name some reference books that they like.
So that's sort of the future of the profession, and I did want to ask about sort of the beginning of the profession, not a history lesson, but Lauren, you wrote the book, So You Want to Be a Librarian. What made you want to tackle that topic for a book, or were you asked to do that, or how did it come about?
Well, I was really fortunate. I was asked to do that by Rory Litwin, who's the publisher. And he asked me to write this book right as I was finishing up library school, because he was specifically looking for someone who had that sort of newer perspective of the graduate program, but also someone who was in the field. And I, as Linda mentioned, was working already in the library. So I was hopefully a good fit for that. And I was excited to write it because even though, like, I wasn't in a place to do good mentoring at that point, I felt I had good information. And I guess mentoring people who weren't in the even down the path yet, I wasn't a place maybe for that. So since mentoring something that's important to me and the future of the field and getting the right people into the field is a really important thing to me. I thought it'd be a fun challenge to do. Not to mention that, you know, not to be stereotypical, but I've always liked the idea of writing a book. So it was sort of a nice opportunity. So yeah, I was able to do that. And I've, you know, it's been fun to get the feedback because people who are in college trying to decide what to do read it. People who are thinking about changing careers read it. I've talked to a few colleagues who are in the field who've read it, who said it was kind of fun to get that big picture perspective, which I kind of like to reread it for that now that I'm further in and more specialized at this point. So yeah, it was a really fun project to do, and it's been neat to hear from people who actually have taken the time to read it.
And Linda, you work a lot with people who are going, who are in the library school program, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have about 7 interns every year who come through.
And do you see a lot of, I guess I shouldn't ask that publicly, but do you see a lot of promise in the...
No, not at all. No, of course. We have, we've had great classes, and our big push has been to get them into instruction, to get them to teach, and that has been, our placement has been wonderful. I think one person has some interviews, but out of the class that just graduated, there are 4 of them. All three of them have jobs now, and one of them is in an interview process still. So we've been very, very happy with our placement rate. And I think a lot of it's just, you know, their own self-motivation. Are they coming to the classes? Are they observing us? Are they trying to teach? Are they looking for those kinds of opportunities? And the students we've chosen have been really motivated. I think the economy helps when it's harder to find a job.
Yeah.
You get scared. So.
Well, you can tell when you're in library school, or basically in any school, I guess, you can tell which of your classmates are going to be successful because they're the ones that are, like you said, motivated to do these things. Some people are just kind of sitting there and not doing much. But
yeah.
I think you see that less probably in grad school than in undergrad, since... a little more of an effort to go to grad school.
Yeah, I mean, with ours, our institution tends to be focused more on school media, so we tend to get the students who want to be academic, and so they, although we have some public library and school media specialists who are in our program, but the ones who are academic really know that they've got to get out there, they've got to learn how to teach.
I do think that. That message is out there. So anyone who's doing any information scanning who's in library school understands that the market is a little bit rough, hopefully, if they've been reading at all. And so I think there is a real drive to get experience. And Linda, I'm so excited to hear you guys are giving them instructional experience, because that's one of the hardest things to get.
Yeah.
But to get an instruction job, you have to have done it. So it's lovely that you guys are setting students up with that.
Yeah, it's been, you know, and it's been good too for our first year instruction coordinator, because she's overwhelmed. I think she taught, I always inflate the number. She fusses at me for this, but I think it was almost 200 classes in 1 year. So it's just a huge amount for one person to teach. And we've been trying to think of innovative ways, mostly her. She's been doing most of this, trying to think of other ways to accommodate this load with people who really want to teach, who are excited about it, and who need it. You know. So it's been good. It's been a really good thing.
That's great. I mentioned earlier that I was going to... ask Linda about one of her posts, and it's you can go back and read it, is on from July 1st. The title is Katy Perry's Case for Information Literacy.
Katy Perry was featured in Parade magazine that day, and she mentioned about how she was using Google to find out about this thing called Fleet Week, which is when, I never knew about this, but it's when the large carriers around big cities will come in for a week and basically have shore leave for a week. And she was going to play, I guess, a USO concert at that. And so she's talked about Googling it, or Wikipediaing it, sorry. And my first reaction was kind of like, oh, dear God, you know, like, Wikipedia, please, you know. But when it really comes down to it, that's a pretty good source for finding information about this. And so... it kind of made me think about my own biases, but almost also made me think about this issue that we've been running into in the library quite a bit, is that how do our students get access to information when they leave our institutions. We are training our students, we're teaching our students to think about information, I think, in a good way, to evaluate information. We're definitely doing that in our information literacy efforts. But when it comes to the finding things part, I'm not sure that we're really filling in that gap. Are they making the connection that they can go to their public library to do these kinds of this kind of work? Or will they just give up and use Google?
And I would say beyond that, we often teach very specific resources in higher education, which might not be available at a public library. It may be, but it might not be, you know. So I think that there is, that's something that I really focus on in my class, is not just the stuff we have, but like how this might look in the real world once you've left us.
Yeah, and I think with y'all have the perfect venue to do that, because they have an information literacy credit course. You have a couple of different things they could take, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it gives you that forum for doing a little bit more with students. Unfortunately, we don't have that. And I do mostly upper-level instruction, where I'm mostly doing the harder, kind of, I guess, more difficult resources. I have to teach things like SimplyMap and the American Fact Finder, the American Community Survey, which... those things, I mean, American Community Survey, they could use outside of the school, but still, like, you have to, in some ways, you have to teach the resource
mm-hmm.
at some points, because it's just a difficult resource to understand. But then how are we kind of making that jump into what does this mean for when you get out of here?
Right. You have to teach them to be able to identify a good source in and of themselves when they're in the real world.
Yeah. But if they... you know, if they aren't making that connection, I guess the big thing, and this is where I want to start thinking about it, is how do you, in a classroom, when you have a one-shot instruction section, how do you make the connection to the public library for when they get out of here?
And also, how do you help them realize that there are times that Wikipedia is totally appropriate?
Right.
Other times, you probably should consider going an extra step.
Right. And I mean, we try to do that. I think we do that pretty well in our first year instruction program.
Mm-hmm.
As far as, because we definitely use Wikipedia in the classroom and talk about how Wikipedia, you know, or get the students to talk about how Wikipedia can be useful. But yeah, I would be interesting to see, like, do a survey of the students who just graduated and students maybe who graduated 5 years ago to see kind of where they're getting their information from.
Mm-hmm.
Especially ones who've gone through our programs, where we know that we had them in our hands at one point.
Linda craves data.
Yeah.
Pick up on that.
Our world craves data. And that's what the whole value of the library stuff is really about, is proving our worth. And the best way to prove worth is to show proof, you know, is to have some kind of numbers in front of you, I think. And it's not just you know, there's also qualitative information that's useful. Definitely.
Yeah, a few years back, I used to be very, one of the very anti-Wikipedia kind of people, but then I realized, this is before I was actually working in libraries, but then I realized at a certain point that even if you can't necessarily trust what you read in the Wikipedia entry, those links at the bottom are very useful, I think.
Exactly.
Like the reference links, because those are usually, a lot of those are to authoritative sources a lot of times.
Yeah. And when we use it for keyword creation or question creation. So in the beginning of the class, we'll have them pick a topic that they all want to just talk about real quickly, and we'll look at Wikipedia entry just to find words. And it really helps students, I think, because they have usually a hump, you know, that they can't get over of, like, okay, my example that I use for political science is war. They want to talk about war. And it's like, well, there's other kinds of terms you could use. It may not just be war you're looking at. You could be looking at conflict. You could be looking at revolutions. You could be looking at all these other terms as well, you know, trying to encourage them to think broadly about their ideas. And I think Wikipedia does that pretty, or is a tool that could be used to do that pretty well.
Right, and at the public library, at least, I mean, we do get a lot of, we get pop culture questions, and that's a lot of times the only place you can get pop culture answers is Wikipedia. I mean, if somebody wants to know about some obscure comic book character or something, I mean, that's not going to be an Encyclopedia Britannica. So.
I think that thing is so, have you guys seen that thing that's so funny where they can compare like Star Wars things to the real thing? So like Jedi Knight versus regular Knight or something like that. And Jedi Knight is way, way longer. So like for pop culture, you just can't beat it. The obsessive fans can go and put all the information in.
Linda, I wanted to ask about that, the webinar series, the Help I'm an Accidental Government Librarian series. How did you get that started?
So the group I work with, the North Carolina Library Association's Government Resources section, and we are a very small org section of that organization. And the members one day were sitting around talking about doing a workshop that would be on this idea of accidental government information librarian, because we had heard more and more people talk about how their library had gotten rid of, or their government more often their government documents librarian has retired. And instead of filling that position with a new person, the duties of that position have been distributed amongst all the librarians, or distributed to the business librarian, or so whatever. And so how do you train those people who weren't, I mean, government documents is a hard area. I mean, it's definitely ha requires some kind of knowledge about how the government does its publishing. And how do you train people to understand all the variety of things that could be involved with being a government information librarian? And we originally thought about doing a workshop in person, but we're just too small. So we decided to do workshops online, using our UNCG's version of what's now called Blackboard Collaborate. And it started out with one, and the person who did the first one, which was, it was called the basics, and so it just went through the real basics of government information and being a government information librarian, like the SUDOC and all those kinds of things. And that first person said that she would agree to do it only if we agreed to do another one. And so then it snowballed after that, and we have one Thursday, which I believe, I don't even know what number it is at this point. I think it's number 19. So that's num no, it's 18. So since April 2011, we've done 18 of these sessions, which is a bit much, but they've been really great, and people of a wide variety of people. It's not just government information librarians. We've had a lot of students, a lot of people who are in maybe state libraries but aren't specifically government information librarians. Just a huge variety of people who come in and attended, and they're always well t attended too. So if you're listening, you should attend.
Everybody go sign up right now.
Yeah. The next one's on the US Department of Agriculture's data, which I'm really excited about because I know nothing about
Yeah, I mean that's
USDA.
yeah, I mean the whole government documents thing, I mean, that's it's really complex but really important.
Yeah, and I mean and it's there's so much of it that is available online, but it requires a certain, it goes back to our research process thing. I mean, that's another place where in the government information session that I do with our interns, we talk more about the process of finding government information and not just here's the SUDOC, here's the monthly catalog. We go through and think about who would care about information, because the government collects a whole lot of information. And unless you can think about that question of who cares, you're not going to be able to do it well. Beyond like knowing that all these sources exist. I mean, I can't keep in my head all of the tons of sources that the government has, but I can think through, okay, what kind of question is this, and where do I think I could go next to be able to find the answer to it?
Yeah, USA.gov is a good little is a good point for a lot of basic things,
Yeah.
but there's so, like you said, there's so much that you can't just,
Yeah.
yeah, so much stuff that you don't even realize what all the government has kept records of.
Yeah, I know. So there was a thread on ILI recently about somebody was going to teach a government information session and what kind of cool things. And there was a zombie page. I think it was the CDC did a page where they talked about the zombie apocalypse and how we could be ready for it. And it was meant to be a joke, but it was also talking about thinking about the idea of pandemics and how do you
Right.
deal with any kind of pandemic problem. And a zombie apocalypse is a great, practice scenario for thinking through that.
I also wanted to ask, Lauren, you're in the middle of writing a very long series on your blog on teaching strategies. I know you're very interested in that sort of technical the theory behind teaching. Is there anything in particular that you made you want to write this series on your blog?
Well, I'm in a new position at my library. I was the instructional design librarian, and now I'm head of instruction. And in my old position, I would run these weekly workshops on improving teaching, which were really well attended and people enjoyed. And one of which was the sort of teaching strategies that the blog post is built on. And I did that once, and then we did some other stuff. And then people wanted it again as sort of a refresher, so I did it again, and then we did some other stuff. And now we're sort of reaching that point where we're really having to carefully evaluate every, you know, free hour of time we have because we're all getting so busy. So I'm going to try to revamp how we do our professional development so it doesn't hit people every week like that. But I did not want to lose that content because I found it useful here, as my colleagues indicated. So I wanted to make sure to document it really well. So I'm going through and making a blog post for every single session of that class, the content we covered, and sort of the way that we did it, so that people who are interested in instruction can follow along. And what you might see if you look at it is that it's not necessarily like walk in a room and do this thing. It's much more the sort of theoretical, as you said, concepts behind education, because a lot of us have sort of figured out or been forced to figure out how to do sort of the technical work of teaching, but to really sort of level up in it and do it a little more effectively, it's helpful to have some of that education perspective. So learning more about how people learn, like how the brain works when you learn, or how learning styles or teaching styles impact learning, or various taxonomies you can use to understand how the library can fit in. And I'm trying to be very intentional with the series to not just write it for teachers, but to write it for anyone who wants to embed in sort of a significant way. So, for example, I think the one that I got up right before the conference was on various taxonomies that talk about student development. And, for example, there's one, Bloom's, which has some controversy around it, but it's still a pretty good framework. And it talks about how, as freshmen, generally students tend to see things as black and white and trust the instructor as an authority and see the world a certain way. And then sort of sophomore, junior year, they go through a period of doubt and seeing gray and thinking people, if you just have a strong enough opinion, maybe that's good enough. And then sort of by senior year, hopefully, they'll get to a point where they see that things are gray, but if you approach things rationally and critically think through things, you'll be able to come to a solution. So if you understand that sort of arc, that can help you understand how to plug in to the student's experience at a given time. Like maybe a freshman just needs to be told, this is how you find the best source. Here are the steps, and they'll learn that. Whereas maybe a senior will want a little bit more pushback and interact, you know, some discussion about why that's the best source, or thinking critically about why that process might make the most sense. So I'm trying to write it both to help the instructor, but also to help people think about the student experience as a whole.
Right. It's very interesting. It's much more in depth than I had ever thought about teaching. So I'm learning things, even though you're on, I think, part 3.2 or something like that.
Right. Yeah, that one got too long. I had to be too post.
Okay. Lauren and Linda, thank you again so much for talking to me for the show. It was very instructive.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Which I'm glad. I guess it's good that it was instructive since you're instructors.
Yeah, otherwise we failed. Well, thanks a bunch. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you.
I'll talk to you guys later.
All right.
Hey, bye. If you'd like to know more about the podcast, you can visit circulatingideas.com or follow the show on Twitter @CircIdeas. You can also like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can contact the show at circulatingideas.mail@gmail.com. Our music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next time.